Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Governor Doug Ducey's Classroom's First Initiative Council closed up shop this week by calling for teachers in Arizona to make more money and a school funding system that is more, quote, predictable and equitable. But the panel is leaving it up to the governor and state lawmakers to decide where that additional money would actually come from. And the governor isn't revealing his plans just yet, saying we'll have to wait until his State of the State address on January 9th. Republican Representative Heather Carter thinks it's time to have a greater vision for education in Arizona, and that would be anchored by paying teachers more.
And even more specifically, targeting those high-performing teachers. We want to make sure we are doing everything we can to attract and retain the best and the brightest teachers in all of our classrooms, from early childhood to the university.
Considering Governor Ducey has made cutting taxes annually one of his top priorities, a revenue increase to pay for education would probably have to come with voter approval, which Carter acknowledges.
Historically, in Arizona, when we have looked at new revenue for a variety of government programs, the Arizona voters have participated in that decision.
That could be a highlight of Arizona's 2018 ballot, or it could be part of a special election. Carter also wants to ask voters to continue a 0.6-cent sales tax hike they approved in 2000 as Proposition 301, specifically earmarked for teacher salaries. That increase would go away in 2021, unless it's extended.
The Federal Reserve yesterday announced an increase in interest rates and that more hikes could be coming in the new year. The move has impacted stocks and bonds, but will also affect other areas of day-to-day life, including housing. And given that industry's importance to the Valley, we wanted to get a sense of how the higher interest rate could impact the housing market here. For answers, I'm joined by Mike Orr, founder of the Cromford Report, which is a resource for the Phoenix housing market. And Mike, what kind of impact do you think the Fed's decision will have on things here?
Well, in itself, I'm not convinced it will have a significant impact because mortgage rates had already risen quite a bit in November ahead of this change. And really, the mortgage rates are influenced by the 10-year Treasury real, not the sort of short-term interest rate that the Fed controls. I mean, it's true that if the Fed increase the rates, then other rates are likely to increase, but there's not a direct relationship. And then you have to ask whether the interest rate is going to have a direct relationship with the housing market. And it's a bit more complex than that.
How so?
Well, I would say that the interest rate has some impact, but other factors are more important in determining demand. For example, the loan approval rate is actually of greater significance. And over the last year, we've seen quite a major uptick in the percentage of loan applications that are getting approval. That means that more people are qualified and approved for a loan. Whether the interest rate is high or not is going to have an impact on how much home they can afford, but whether they buy a home or not is much more controlled by the approval rate. So that actually has a bigger impact on the market. The other minor effects is, I think, as rates go up, you'll probably see a few more people being tempted to use adjustable rates to keep their to what they can afford and what they would like. And we're still going to see a significant margin so that, you know, if you're not expecting to be in the home more than 5 years, a 5-1 arm may seem like a pretty good option. We may have an issue with people who are currently in a home deciding to stay put because their current mortgage rate is lower than what they could get if they bought a new home or bought an existing home. If you've currently got a rate of, say, 3.5%, and next year it looks like you might have to change to 4.5%, that's a good incentive to stay put.
Do you expect, then, that builders might scale back some of their plans somewhat and make slightly smaller houses or go back to the, you know, sort of in the far suburbs where things are a little bit less expensive so that folks who maybe will have to pay more on their mortgage payments can still buy the same amount of house or a smaller house closer in?
I think it would be advisable for developers to focus a little bit more down market because that's where the unsatisfied demand is. And as interest rates rise, people will be limited by their income to quite possibly a smaller or less expensive home because more of their payment is going to be eaten up by interest. There is a lot of demand which is going unsatisfied for sort of entry-level homes. People are staying in rentals for a number of different reasons. There is plenty of demand for the sort of move-up homes too, and builders have been focusing on that because it tends to be a little bit more profitable to focus on the mid-range home rather than the starter home.
Have you seen any evidence that builders are looking at smaller homes or sort of that downscale market a little bit like you talked about?
A little bit. The average size in square foot of livable space has declined a bit over the last couple of years. And there are definitely a few builders who specialize in the sort of lower end, more affordable homes. To build an affordable home, though, they usually have to find land that is a long way from the center of the valley, which allows them to, you know, end up with a home that's going to be finished for somewhere in the sort of 150 to 200,000 price range. That is very hard to find a home, attractive home at that sort of price anywhere close to the center of the valley, but you can find them in more distant places such as parts of Pinal County or South Buckeye. And I've seen an increase in the activity in those sort of locations.
Mike Orr is founder of the Cromford Report, which is a resource for the Phoenix housing market. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. Until the president-elect reassures us or takes significant steps to separate his business holdings from his powers as president, we'll be asked to believe that a man who's made his career out of making big deals and talking about his net worth will just put all of that aside and prioritize the American people after he's inaugurated in January.
President-elect Trump was scheduled to hold a news conference today to address his many business-related conflicts of interest, but that's been postponed. According to officials, part of the Trump team, he will address those issues in January before he's inaugurated. But can he? Any one of his business interests would be a huge political scandal if discovered in the middle of another presidency. Take the former old post office, Trump International Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. Does Trump have to dump it? The Trump Organization's response on Twitter is that his sons will run the business and he will make no new deals while in office. Then there is Secretary of State nominee Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, who sanctioned oil development deals with Russia, could already be worth billions of dollars and billions more if the sanctions come off. Just to what degree are these conflicts from Trump and his cabinet already harming U.S. interests, and what are the consequences for a government that appears to be personally enriching themselves through public service? It's a hard legal question even for hardened cynics. Matthew Sanderson is an attorney for Kaplan and Drysdale.
In my mind, the only way to really handle this is to sell them to an outside party now. So, and that could involve either selling off individual assets, or more efficient would be to hold an initial public offering and basically put it on the stock market. And that way the public is able to buy and evaluate the company. And he would put the proceeds of selling all of his stock into a what's called a blind trust, where an independent trustee then has all of this money, and the trustee, independent of Mr. Trump, decides what to buy and sell. And so he would not have a picture into what kind of commercial interests he has on a regular basis. And that would divorce the government decision-making from the financial planning aspects of his personal finances.
Now, we should note that Trump has given absolutely no indication that he's willing to go this far, right?
That's right. So far, what he's saying is that he will turn over managerial responsibility to his children and to his executives. And he's calling this a blind trust, but it's just not credible to say that this is a blind trust.
He's their dad. I mean, they listen to their dad, and he's the boss, and he's the president. There's no blind there.
Yeah, it's a blind trust that is neither blind nor a trust. It doesn't do anything to solve his conflicts problem because, again, any favorable government decision, foreign government, domestic government agency, he would benefit personally. His net worth would go up anytime there's a favorable government decision.
Do you remember the era of Whitewater? In the term of the of Bill Clinton in the 90s,
yes,
and that was basically a land holding deal that supposedly was mixed up with governments favors and the possibility that Hillary and Bill Clinton would have been enriched by purchase of this land that they received on favorable terms. Nothing ever went anywhere with Whitewater, but it went forever and ever and ever. Is it the case that we are on day one of the Trump administration, we're like Whitewater times a thousand, and there's nothing even to investigate? It's all right there.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so he has a decision to make. Does he want to deal with these stories throughout his presidency, or does he want to, quote, make America great again? Does he want to pursue his agenda? Because this will become a significant drag on his presidency overall. And, you know, these are legitimate stories. These, you know, I'm a Republican lawyer. There are Republicans out there talking about this. There are people of all political stripes talking about this. And you can't in one breath say that the Clintons, that Hillary Clinton didn't deserve to be elected because she was so conflicted because of the Clinton Foundation or because of Whitewater, because of other similar deals. And then in the next breath, pursue all sorts of business deals with foreign governments or pursue business deals with shady partners that will inevitably result in scandal. And so he just has to decide whether he wants to treat the presidency as a full-time job and whether he wants to actually pursue his agenda. If he doesn't treat this in a serious way, this will haunt him for the next 4 years.
Finally, Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, who's the designate for Secretary of State, there's a half-trillion-dollar Arctic oil deal stuck in sanctions. Does the outcome of that become a conflict of interest for a Secretary of State? Is there any way to insulate either Rex Tillerson, Exxon, or the Trump organization from the benefits of that?
Well, I think Tillerson's in a little bit he's in a complicated situation, but it's a little bit different and a little bit more manageable because he does hold currently Exxon stock and some options. But, you know, Exxon is a publicly traded company. So before he takes office, before he becomes the Secretary of State, he can sell those off. There's obviously a public market for that, and that would resolve the conflict. But this kind of gets back to, I think, what has become a complicated situation because you not only have the president-elect who has a very complex conflict of interest, but you also have Tillerson and Ross and DeVos and McMahon and Ricketts, and the list goes on and on of extremely high net worth individuals. That's why this is such a complex situation. Usually you only have one of these people, one or two high net worth individuals who are in high-level positions in government. This is an unprecedented challenge.
Matthew Sanderson is a Republican attorney for Kaplan and Drysdale. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thank you, Matthew.
Good to be with you.
And that's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. 'Tis the season for spending. The National Retail Federation expects sales in November and December to increase about 3.5%. The group's annual consumer survey finds debit and credit cards are the most popular payment forms, with only 1 in 5 shoppers planning to use cash. But as Christina Estes reports from the KJZZ Business Desk, in some places, dollars remain dominant.
Hi, can I help you?
Yes, can I have a 3-piece fish and chips? And
most restaurants are proud of what they serve. And that applies to Pete's Fish and Chips.
Deep fried, hot, best onion rings in town.
But owner Kathy Adams is equally proud of what they don't serve.
We don't serve ketchup. We serve Pete's sauce. We make it.
They also don't serve credit or debit card users.
Cash only.
When Adams' father Pete opened his food stand in Phoenix, no one even had credit cards. Fast forward 70 years. Pete's has grown to 8 Valley locations, and not a single one will take a single card.
We don't owe anybody, and nobody owes us anything. We close our books, and we start fresh the next day.
It's going to be $5.59 at the window.
Thank you.
They also don't have to pay fees that banks charge retailers. They're typically 2 to 4% of each credit card transaction.
I want the 2-piece fish and chips.
Mesa resident Brandon Louie is a fan of Pete's signature meal and its business model.
I'm not in favor of a cashless society because I think it hurts the poor.
Louis says he carries cash every day. So do nearly 70% of consumers, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco.
for a lot of consumers, you know, there's a tipping point.
Wendy Matheny says the tipping point for the average person to choose a credit card over cash is about $25. She co-wrote the Fed's report on the state of cash released last month. It's based on diaries in which people tracked what they bought and how they paid. The youngest and oldest surveyed reported using cash most often, while 35 to 44-year-olds used it the least. Across all age groups, Matheny says,
cash is still the most frequently used payment form.
But cash's share of payments has dropped 8 percentage points since the Fed survey in 2012. Still, it doesn't mean cash is dying. Matheny says growth continues in what the Fed calls currency in circulation.
It's basically the difference in what comes in from banks and depository institutions and what we send back out, what they're asking for us. And so what we've seen over time is the demand going out has actually increased.
Sometimes that's attributed to natural disasters. For example, people may rush to withdraw cash if they know a hurricane is heading their way. Sometimes demand spikes when people in other countries lose confidence in their money.
But I might hold on to U.S. dollars because I know the full faith and credit of the United States government is backing this $100 U.S. bill, whereas my day-to-day currency may not.
And sometimes demand jumps based on the time of year, like Christmas.
Order number 68.
Back at Pete's Fish and Chips, the desire for dollars never drops.
$6.94.
We still believe in cash is king.
Owner Kathy Adams does her best to get that message across. Painted on the buildings and plastered on menu boards are the words cash only. Most people catch it, but for those who don't, well, they're invited to use the ATM parked near the register.
Thank you.
And KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Estes joins me now. And Christina, am I right? You didn't actually bring any Pete's secret sauce, is that right?
Sorry, no sauce.
But instead, you know, you brought a quiz.
I did. We're going to see how well you know money. It's a quick quiz courtesy of the Federal Reserve to help people separate cash facts from common myths. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, true or false? Demand for U.S. currency is growing.
This is a little bit of cheating, but I'm going to say yes because I heard your story earlier this week about the Fed's cash processing center here in Phoenix.
You were listening. Thank you, thank you. That is right. As of March of this year, the Fed says more than 38 billion notes were in circulation. Those notes were valued at $1.4 trillion. Now let's move on to your wallet. Oof. Where I'm guessing there's not trillions.
No.
So how much cash do you have right now?
I'm going to guess, I don't know, maybe like $20.
Hey, okay, so don't guess on this one. True or false, the average consumer carries less than $10 in cash.
I'm going to go with false because ATMs typically only give you 20. So if you go to an ATM, you can't get less than 20.
Maybe that's the rationale behind this. The Fed says the average consumer carries slightly more than $20 in cash. Ready for the next question?
Yes.
Okay, true or false, most shopping takes place in stores, not online.
I would have to say online.
Why?
Am I right?
Why?
I just think people think it's more convenient. There's more selection. People don't have time. You know, you can shop at any hour of the day as opposed to the hours the store is open.
That's what I thought, too, because you think, oh, I'm going to buy something. I'm just going to go online and do it and not deal with the hassle.
Not true.
Well, this is about quantity. So think about all of the little things, the filling up the gas, getting a cup of coffee, buying a little gift for a fun reporter that you work with.
Yeah, I'm still waiting on your list.
So it's all those little things. And so they say that most of the purchases are done by cash.
Huh, interesting. You have the full quiz, Christina, along with some other fun facts and infographics on our website, kjzz.org. Christina Estes, thanks.
You're welcome.
Arizona is one of the top 10 states in the country for new arrivals of refugees from all over the world, and most of them are women and children. The Refugee Women's Health Clinic at Maricopa Integrated Health Systems was built to address their needs. The show's Lauren Gilger spoke with the woman who founded that clinic about her work serving women who've undergone the practice of female genital cutting. And Lauren joins me now. Lauren, this isn't something you expect to hear about in the U.S., let alone in Arizona. Is this practice something that's commonly seen here?
Well, there are about 200 million women and girls across the world affected by female genital mutilation, which is also called cutting or female circumcision, in sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, and the Middle East. And many refugees from those areas of the world end up resettling here in Arizona. As you mentioned, I spoke with Dr. Krista Johnson Adbakwu about this. She's the director of the Refugee Women's Health Clinic here in the Valley. And she told me that much of her work is focused on training the community of providers about this practice and how to treat many of the complications that can result from it.
Often this is performed on girls, most commonly either in infancy or between the ages of 5 and 10, where often girls may not have a choice. That's why this has become a human rights issue, because how can we protect girls and women from undergoing cultural procedures for which they have no say-so in what's done to their bodies, and that can have significant impact on their life?
And just how large is this population of refugees here in Arizona?
More than 75,000 refugees have been resettled here in Arizona, and each year more than 4,000 new arrivals come to our state, according to Johnson at Bakwu. And she said Arizona also has the highest rate of complex medical cases among its refugee population.
These are populations who have survived enormous human rights abuses and atrocities, torture, war. They have lost their families. They've lost everything. And so we see very complex cases. For instance, we have a high number of Congolese refugees being resettled who've been survivors of sexual violence and raped. And they're now trying to rebuild their lives in the U.S. and learn English and take care of their families, get their kids in school, and survive. And that pathway to economic self-sufficiency is so steep because they receive support for just a short period of time in mm-hmm. terms of cash assistance and housing. And, you know, the priority is getting a job and to get the kids in school and really be able to live and thrive in America. But yet, how do you heal from what you've lived through and what you've survived and the horrendous shame and stigma and challenges that you need to also wrestle with as you're trying to deal with surviving in America and making a living and supporting
your
family.
Which isn't easy to begin with,
exactly.
Right? To resettle in a
exactly.
new country.
So you can just imagine this is the vulnerable population that we serve.
How does your work with genital cutting and come into play?
So we serve a very large East African population here, largely Somali women. We have some Sudanese, Eritrean, Ethiopian women. Those are the populations here in Arizona that are most profoundly affected by genital cutting. And because this is such a taboo subject, it's something that needs to be addressed with sensitivity and care. Recognize that we're currently living in a time frame in our history where there's intense anti-immigrant and anti-refugee rhetoric, even anti-Muslim rhetoric. And these are the very labels that are attached to the very communities affected by this practice. And so we really have to be sensitive to that and recognize that even this topic area in these communities is highly taboo. And so what we felt was very critical is to build trust. And we have what we call cultural health navigators, who are women who are bicultural, who speak the language of these populations, who come from these same communities, who have shared experiences of displacement due to war and conflict, but they're also certified medical interpreters, and they're part of our health staff. And so they bridge that important gap between the large, big, scary, intimidating health system and mm-hmm, hospital mm-hmm. and the women, her family, and the larger community.
So even if you did know there was a high refugee population here in Arizona, you odds are would not think about genital cutting as something that is seen here often. Like you mm-hmm. think about it as something that happens on the other side of the world.
Yes, but what's critical is that, yes, many of these women have been cut overseas in their home country or during their process of displacement. However, they are living with the long-term health effects. And that's where it is front and center for providers to be aware, because we are providing care. We are taking care of women who are pregnant. There might be a lot of shame and stigma that women may not even be comfortable seeking care because of prior experiences that have been negative with providers mm-hmm. who may not have been culturally sensitive. And also bear in mind that there is a spectrum of views about being circumcised. Some women are outraged and horrified that this was done against their will and are seeking help. But I also see the other side of women who are very proud of their circumcision and defend it staunchly mm-hmm. because it's a sign of their pride and honor. And what research hasn't yet elucidated is how do we best understand these various degrees of perceptions about this practice and meet women wherever they might fall? So we really need to engage in much greater transparency and partnership with communities, with women, families, leaders, educational leaders and the school system, the healthcare system, pediatricians. So it's very multi-pronged and multifaceted to really get at some of the core issues and the approaches that are most culturally appropriate to really tackling this issue.
And Johnson Agbakwu has been working through the Women's Refugee Clinic for the last several years to build that kind of network, to approach this issue of female genital cutting. And they recently received a $1 million grant to train providers to offer outreach to the refugee community and to the healthcare community, among other things, across Arizona for women who are affected by this practice.
The show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Researchers at Barrow Neurological Institute have made what they're calling a groundbreaking discovery of genes linked to ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. But they didn't do it alone. They had some high-tech help, courtesy of IBM Watson, the artificial intelligence system. For more on this, I'm joined by Dr. Robert Bowser, chair of neurobiology at the Barrow Neurological Institute. And Robert, what do these findings actually mean?
Yeah, so it's an exciting finding. So what we've used IBM Watson to do is to try to sort of accelerate our ability to look for new mechanisms or new angles of why people develop ALS. So what we did was we asked Watson specific questions about, here's what we know about the disease, and can you help us identify or make predictions in new ways in which we can go?
Was Watson's role more of doing things more quickly than humans could, or was it more involved than that?
Well, it's definitely more quickly than humans can do, because it can sort of look and read and understand all the literature ever published, and I could never do that in a thousand lifetimes. So it's quicker than what humans can do. But another important aspect is, you know, we were actually helping Watson learn about neurosciences as well. So it's the first time that somebody has tried to employ IBM Watson to study a neurologic problem. And so that's another exciting aspect of what our partnership has developed.
So now that you've identified these genes that are associated with ALS that it sounds like you didn't know were associated with ALS before, what's the next step? What do you do with that information?
Right. So a little bit about, you know, how we discovered or what we discovered. So we discovered... We asked Watson specific questions about a class of genes, and it rank ordered the genes which it felt were most predictive to be changed in ALS. We then took the top candidates and actually looked in tissue samples from ALS patients and people without ALS, and 9 out of the top 10 were all changed in people with ALS. So the proteins that they encode seem to be altered in ALS. And of those top 10 candidates, 5 of them were never before ever linked or associated with ALS. So it's not something that me just looking at the literature would have been able to identify and predict. It was Watson using its sort of cognitive computing capacity to make the inferences that led us to those 5 additional proteins.
How do you expect to use that information as far as coming up with treatments or potentially even a cure?
Right. So now... what we're doing is taking this newfound knowledge of these additional proteins and mapping out the mechanisms of how they function and looking for what we call a convergence point. So is there within the sort of the biological pathways and how these function a convergence point where they all seem to work together? And so that becomes a target for drug discovery and drug development.
Is it safe to describe, do you think, sort of what you found and what you might be able to use going forward as maybe having a better sense of where to look now as far as what might cause ALS and what might change in patients with ALS, which gives you a better sense of how to deal with that?
Yes. Yeah, I would agree. So what this helps is sort of as an analogy, we all, scientists, clinicians, we all sort of look where the street light is currently on. And so what the use of IBM Watson has done is basically turned on another street light. And so now we can look and look for new mechanisms and new potential drugs under the spotlight of the new light that's been turned on by Watson.
Dr. Robert Bowser is chair of neurobiology at Barrow Neurological Institute. The way animals are kept in zoos has evolved a lot in the U.S. over the last 30 years. And in Phoenix, one woman in particular has been behind that evolution. And it turns out the impact of her work reaches far beyond Arizona. KJZZ's Naomi Gingold reports.
When Hilda Trez was 17, she walked into the office of the director of the Budapest Zoo and demanded a job.
I was a young, ignorant child who doesn't know that you're not supposed to just march into the director's office and tell him things.
And she kept doing it for a year, telling him,
I just want to be a zookeeper. I think he just did that to shut me up.
Meaning he made her one. The day after she graduated from high school, Trez started at the zoo. Hilda Trez actually grew up in the city of Budapest, but every summer she'd go to her grandmother's in the countryside, and that's where she fell in love with animals. There were cows, pigs, geese, and one time she realized
there were no lakes or ponds for my grandmother's ducks. So what does a good child do? Digs a big hole, fills it up with water,
and makes a pond. Okay, more like a mud pile, but her grandmother wasn't exactly excited about it. But Trez thought, you know, ducks need water. She didn't know that this was an early sign of what she'd be doing later in life. At 26, she and her husband left Hungary and came to the U.S. She ended up at the Primate Foundation of Arizona, taking care of 85 chimpanzees. And she says the experience changed her life.
Because they are just like human. They really are. So they try you in every one way.
From scheming to throw their poop at her to even grooming her when they decided they liked her. It required an entirely new level of problem solving and patience. Not long after, she moved to the nearby Phoenix Zoo. And in the early 2000s, Trez started a program around an idea that was gaining traction in the zoo world, behavioral enrichment. She says often,
people think that behavioral enrichment is nothing else but entertaining animals, throwing a toy at them, and that's it.
But whether it's changing the architecture of their exhibit or making animals forage and work for their food, behavioral enrichment is about giving animals items and opportunities that bring out natural behaviors they'd have in the wild. Trez says that means giving them a lever of control over their lives.
When you give an enrichment item for an animal, it has a choice to either interact with it or even not to interact with it. And it's a big difference, even for humans. If you have no choice, you feel helpless, you feel hopeless, angry, depressed. It's the same with animals.
In 2006, Trez gave a talk at a conference about her approach to behavioral enrichment.
The next day, the telephone was off the hook and my emails were flooded. And everybody was asking me that, what am I doing? And where do we buy our feeders? And just a million things. And it's just kind of from that point took off.
Today, what this all means is that if you go to the Phoenix Zoo, you will basically not notice any of the behavioral enrichment program at all. Because it's the kind of thing that humans totally miss unless someone points it out.
Hi, girl. I'm Sheena.
Sheena is not a puppy. She's a 7,200-pound Asian elephant at the Phoenix Zoo. Trez explains that elephants have two main activities in the wild.
Elephants eat, elephant walks. Elephant eats, elephant walks. So we have to make our elephants walk. And our elephants have to work their joints.
So the terrain is uneven. There are scattered logs all around, scratching posts. And they have to work to find the feeders with the food. Feeders that are hard to get food out of. It may not be beautiful to the human eye, but the key word here is functionality. In 2007, the Jane Goodall Institute contacted Trez, and today she goes to zoos around the world to help with chimp and animal welfare. Sometimes the zoos invite her. Other times, someone reports animal abuse and she gets brought in. In those cases, zoo staff is not happy to have her. But by the end of the 1 week she gets with them, sentiments usually change. Recently, when she left Sri Lanka, they told her,
We would have thought that you were a Buddhist because you are following the Lord Buddha's teaching without even knowing that you're doing it. And that actually made me feel pretty good about my job. So I think it doesn't matter how I am getting brought back to those countries because at the end, what it matters to how I come out.
Really, she says, it's just about the animals, making sure they have better lives. Humans, she says, at least they can talk. Animals don't have a voice, if not for people like Hilda Trez. Naomi Gingold, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Here we go. Come on, buddy.
Hi, this is John. We're watching bull riding here at the Buffalo Chipping Cave Creek.
Here we go.
Hi, I'm Helen. I'm with my husband, and we've moved here like 4 years ago from Washington State. And when you come to Cape Crete, you have to be involved with things like this because it's a cowboy town, and we love it.
Wow. We always dress the part. Yes.
When you come here, you have to.
We got the boots. We got the hats. Yes. And yeah. You got to look the part. I'm very glad that it's not me on that ball. These people have a lot of guts to do it, the ladies and the guys. I certainly wouldn't do it.
Finishing, come on, cheer him on. Oh.
It's like, really? I mean, how can you stay on that long? Wow.
Come on, cheer him on, yeah!
That's John and Helen McFarlane watching Bull Riders in Cave Creek. If your suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we could use a good bucking, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.